And KBOO Portland says thank you when you offer your financial support. Just as everyone did during our recent membership drive, brought us way over our goal. Thank you very much. Coming up this morning on KBOO, next, One Land Many Voices with Zaha Hassan. And at 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints, looking at how the shooting in Canada's parliament is being used to ramp up the war against ISIS. That's right. At 11, Suzanne Legrand hosts Startup City, with a focus on new opportunities for jobs in the tech industry. At 11:10, host Sarika Mehta speaks with Rick Steves, host of Rick Steves Europe, about his support for Oregon Ballot Measure 91, legalizing cannabis, and with journalist and filmmaker Jose Antonio Vargas about his support for Oregon Ballot Measure 88, driver cards. At 11:30, Chris Andre is back to discuss Imago Theater's production of Harold Pinter's The Homecoming. And now, this.
Help support KBOO Community Radio by donating your used car, truck, motorcycle, boat, or any other vehicle. We'll transform the old machine into resources for unserved and underserved communities, free training, recording equipment, and great programming for the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world. For more information about vehicle donation, call 1-877-KBOO-123 or go to kboo.fm/vehicle.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center. While cinema provides entertainment and escape, for many filmmakers and viewers, it is a vital portal into the lives of others, a medium of engagement, and a powerful tool for social action. Films will be shown from Thursday, October 6th through Wednesday, November 9th, and include the films Familia, Sing Your Song, An African Election, Windfall, and more. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center, located at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information about the films can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
. 20% of all available jobs in Oregon pay $10 or less. Unemployment hovers at 7%. Yet, in the tech industry in Portland, there's a different problem. Too many jobs and not enough applicants. For those who know computer programming or are willing to learn, there's lots of opportunities to get high-paying jobs in the tech industry. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for Coders Wanted, Part 2 of Startup City, how the new tech boom is changing Portland.
And this is One Land Many Voices, coming up with Zaha Hassan.
Good morning, this is Zaha Hassan, and you're listening to One Land Many Voices on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. My co-host, Ned Roche, is getting ready to travel to Gaza with Physicians for Social Responsibility, and so he is not with us in the studio today. Ned will be back next month with stories and interviews to share. Safe travels, Ned. Today on the program, we'll be checking in on some of the stories Ned and I have covered on the program for you. The first of these is the case of Tariq Abu Khdeir, a 15-year-old Palestinian-American boy who was brutally beaten by Israeli occupation forces and imprisoned without charge during his summer vacation to visit family in East Jerusalem. And the other is that of Stephen Salida, a Palestinian-American university professor who had his job offer at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign revoked because of tweets he sent out during the bombing campaign conducted by Israel in July and August of this year. In the second half hour of the show, we'll be joined by Peter Miller, outgoing chair of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, which just held its very successful 13th annual convention in San Diego, California last month. Peter, who is also the president of Portland-based Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, will be giving us a roundup of the U.S. campaign's boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS work, and its solidarity actions, which Portland has been very active in supporting. But first, let's take a listen to Tariq Abukhdian and his mother, Suha, who both spoke at the U.S. campaign's conference last month about their experiences following a wave of violence that was taking place in the West Bank and Gaza this last summer, which culminated in the bombardment and invasion of Gaza on July 8th. If our listeners will recall, on July 2nd, settlers abducted the 16-year-old cousin of Tariq Abukhdian, Muhammad, from near his home in East Jerusalem, purportedly as revenge for the disappearance of three Israeli settlers who had been hitchhiking in the West Bank. Muhammad's charred body was later found in a forested area in Jerusalem. Though three Israelis confessed to the murder of Muhammad, they have yet to be tried. Yusuf Haim Ben David, the 29-year-old ringleader of the group, was supposed to plead insanity at his hearing on Monday, October 20th, but instead a three-month continuance was granted. And now Tariq and Suha Abukhdian.
Thank you for having me tonight, and good evening. I'm happy to be back in the U.S., safe. And when I went overseas, I went through a tough time. And actually, when I arrived in Palestine, the Israelis kept me in the airport for 10 hours. At that time, I was confused. So I thought about it a little bit. I thought about the conflict between Israel and Palestine. And as we speak right now, the Palestinian people are suffering. And I visited Palestine for 6 weeks, and what happened to me was just a small taste of what they go through every single day. And the Palestinians do not have rights. And actually, when I went over there, I forgot that I had freedom. And I wish, now that I'm back, I wish they have the same freedom that I have. And I appreciate freedom more now that I'm back in the U.S. And I'm just an average kid from... I was born in Baltimore and moved to Temple when I was 11, and I'm 15, and I'm in 10th grade right now, and I started school already. And now about my cousin, Muhammad Abukhdian. He was my first friend that I made when I went to Palestine this year, because I haven't been to Palestine for 11 years. So right when I went there, I saw him with all my other cousins. And then we became friends on the spot. We went out every day, we had so much fun, we stayed up all night, we were having so much fun. So one night during the month of Ramadan, I passed by him and I said hi to him. And I was on the way to the bakery so I could buy some food. And I said hi and then I drove off. I came back and then I see the cops were exactly where he was sitting. Then I asked, and there was only one of my cousins that were there, and I asked him, I was like, what happened? He told me that they kidnapped Muhammad. And that, right when he told me that, so many things went in my mind. I was thinking, like, is he gonna come back? Is he gonna come back alive? What are they gonna do to him? Where is he right now as we speak? Is he saying anything? Can anybody hear him? So at that point, I got a call the same second he told me that he was kidnapped. And it was my cousin. He's like, what are you doing at night, 4:30 at night, sitting outside? And I'm like, bro, Muhammad just got kidnapped. So then all my cousins, all of Shafat came down. And they were like, where is he? We need to know where he is right now. And we were talking to the cops. And the cops asked me, were you the last person to see him? And I said, yes. All I saw, he was just sitting there in front of his house. And then I drove off and I came back and I saw you guys. So later on, a couple hours later, we found out that he was killed. I found out actually first, and I didn't want to tell anybody. I just sat by myself. Everybody looked at me and looked at me like, why are you sad? And he's like, and I'm like, and my cousins are like, why are you sad? He's going to be back. He's going to come back. We have to be positive. And I'm telling them, I hope so, in God's will. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, is this true? Is I don't want to think about it like in a bad way, but did he really get stabbed and burnt alive? Could that really happen? Could somebody actually do that to another person? And I was scared for his life. And then he was stabbed and burnt alive, and then finally everyone found out when they announced it in the mosque. And when they announced it in the mosque, everyone just dropped. They were like, is it true? We don't even know how someone could do that to someone else. And to even make it worse, they began to fire rubber-coated metal bullets at us, at everyone. They even were firing at my mother, at my aunts and uncles that were inside their houses. They were shooting at every house. And it was so sad and inhumane that they could do that when we lost someone in our family. We're the ones, my mom is still grieving, and my cousin's mom, my aunt, is still grieving over her son's death. When he was murdered, we thought to ourselves that we tried our best to think that he was gonna come back until we found out of everything. To make it worse, later on that day, I was on the side of the street when there were some protesters in front of me, and they were being the IDF firing rubber bullets at them. And that's when I was on the side, and I'm thinking to myself, is this really happening in front of me? Are they really firing rubber bullets to the whole city, to my family? It made me think how could this happen right in front of me? And then I heard Israeli soldiers behind me. I'm thinking that they're gonna run by me and just shoot like the rest of the soldiers did. They began to run after me. That's when I panicked. And everyone began to scream and panic too, and then they ran. And I began to run too, because I panicked. I didn't know what to do. And that's when they stuck to me. Three of them were running after me, one person. And that's when I jumped the fence on my left, and I was at a dead end. And that's when, it was not actually a dead end, there was like a little drop, like a 10-foot drop in front of me, which everyone jumped. I was going to jump it, because I was scared, and so many things were running through my mind. So when I was about to jump it, they tackled me, and punched me, and zip-tied me. So I couldn't make any movements. I was zip-tied, leg-cuffed, and beaten, punched and kicked in the face till I was unconscious. And even when I went unconscious, they kept punching and kicking me like I was a punching bag. And I woke up blindfolded in jail. I woke up like I thought I was in the same place, the same, I felt like I was in my cousin's place. God rest his soul. I felt like I was in his place. I'm like, where am I? Are they gonna kill me? Am I gonna live through this? And I'm bleeding down my neck, and I'm bleeding down every part of my body. And I feel like my face is like a bubble because of how much it hurt. And after being 6 hours in jail, they took me to jail. After being in jail for 6 hours, they finally took me to a doctor. And when I went to that doctor, I went unconscious again. And I woke up and I saw my dad and my uncle in front of me. They said, you might come back home with us tonight, or you might go to jail. I thought to myself, why would I go to jail? They beat me up. And later on, I began to drink and eat. And while I was drinking and eating, the soldier came up to me and told me to go get dressed. I'm going back to jail. And I'm like, okay. Couldn't say anything. So I went to the bathroom, I changed back into my clothes, back into the same clothes. I was in a gown in the hospital. I had to change back into the same clothes that had all my blood on it and my ripped shirt. And I went back to the jail. And I saw all my cousins in jail, and it was so sad. Like the way that it's inhumane, how you could just take a bunch of kids for no reason and beat them. I saw my cousin sitting right next to me, and his whole shoulder is dislocated, and I saw his shoulders bleeding. And I'm looking at myself like, how? How is this happening to me? How's it happening to all the Palestinians? How do they live through this? I stayed in jail for 4 days. Oh, actually, on the second day I was in jail, they said I went to a court date. I went to the court, sat in a jail cell inside the court, didn't even get to go to my court date. They just tortured us. They put us in a cell inside the court. 9 people in a closed cell, and it was so small. We had to stand. We couldn't sit down. For 6 hours, we kept standing in that cell. We couldn't do anything until one by one was called, and I wasn't called. So that's when I returned to jail. 2 days later, I had another court date. That's when the same thing happened. I went to the jail cell, stayed in there for a couple of hours. Then finally, I got out, and there was a bunch of media in front of me. I was getting a bunch of questions, and that's when right when I walked into the courtroom, I saw my parents. My face lit up. I was so happy, and I could, so many things were running through my mind. I'm like, I'm finally going home. I'll think about everything when I go home. And then the judge told me I was gonna be on house arrest. Usually when I think about house arrest, I'm like, house arrest. I don't know what that is. Until she told me that I'm not allowed to go back to the city where my parents are staying. You're supposed to stay away from your family. Why should I stay away from my family? They're like trying to torture me. And so they did all this with no charges. That's what they do to all the Palestinian people, with no charges filed. So, and the day I left Palestine, they attacked all my cousins again, the rest of them. They took half my cousins when I was there, and then they took the rest when I left. The night I left, they waited for me to leave, then they took my cousins. They ransacked my house that I was staying in. They took my 5th-year-old uncle. The one, he got back from work and they took him. And my cousin that goes to work, he works every single day from 11 in the morning to 6 in the morning the next day. And they took him. He was so tired. And I really want to thank everyone who supported me. And it's sad that my cousins are still being persecuted. And the 3 cousins that were arrested with me, their names are Kareem, Muhammad, and Mahmoud. And they were arrested and they're still in jail because they're not American and they didn't have a video that showed the brutality of the Israelis. Now, I think all people should be treated equal, and no matter who they are or where they come from, we were all created equal and we all deserve to have our rights. And I feel my cousins should have the same rights that the Israelis give the Israelis, the Israel gives the Israelis. And giving Palestinians the same rights is a key to peace in the Middle East. I pray one day my cousins can feel safe outside, feel safe to play outside and have fun. And I don't want them to be scared when they're outside trying to play with their other cousins. And it's inhumane. I can't explain it. It's really sad. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I want to thank the U.S. campaign to end the occupation for having us here tonight. We're honored to be here. My name is Suha Abu Qadir. I'm the mother of Tariq Abu Qadir. I cannot begin to describe the pain of seeing my beloved son held in an Israeli prison without charges, denied medical care, and suffering from a brutal beating given to him by the Israeli police. When I first heard about the vicious beating he faced at the hand of the Israeli police and saw his bloody and swollen face and his unconscious body in the hospital, I feared for his life, and I didn't know if he was going to survive. I could not bear to watch the video of his beating. What if he was screaming for my help, and I could not be there for him? When I arrived at the hospital, when I found out about him being in jail and then taken to the hospital, I found an Israeli policeman at the hospital bedroom door, and I asked him if I can go in and see my son. He refused at first. After my husband had pleaded with him, he finally allowed me, but proceeding to say, "You cannot get near him, you can't touch him, and you can't speak to him." So I proceeded to go to the hospital room, and I looked over, and all I can see is this helpless body laying there with it. He had a distorted face. I did not recognize him. I didn't know if he was alive, what had happened exactly. So I told my husband, "Please don't leave him," because he was handcuffed to the hospital bed. And I felt like since he was handcuffed to the hospital bed, that the same people that brought him to the hospital could take him right back. So I was afraid. The next morning, we got a call from the American consular, Josh Wagner, and he told us that he had made an appointment for all of us to go and see Tariq in jail. I found out before Josh Wagner called, of course, I found out that they took Tariq back to jail, and I couldn't believe it. I knew he was on antibiotics, so the first thought I had was, are they really gonna give him his antibiotics? Are they gonna take care of him? Are they gonna feed him? And especially after seeing how the condition he was in, I couldn't bear to think that he was in a jail cell when he should have stayed in the hospital. So the next morning we went with Josh Wagner to the jailhouse. So when we proceeded and told the Israeli police that Josh Wagner had an appointment to see Tariq today, they said no one was going to see any prisoners, and that was it. And they closed the prison doors in our face. Josh Wagner could not believe it. He told them, "I am not going to leave here until I see him, because I made an appointment with you guys, and I'm going to stay until I can see him." He proceeded to call the embassy, the US embassy and the Israeli embassy, back and forth for 3 hours until finally they agreed to let him in alone. So when he got in, before he got in, I told him, "Please, Josh, can you just, let me know of his condition. Let me know, ask him how, is he eating? Are they giving him his medications?" Because the medications are in Hebrew. So he can't read Hebrew. So these are the same people that beat him that now are caring for him. I'm grateful to be back in America, safe with my son. But no Palestinians go through what my son faced every day. Tariq was not able to grieve his cousin's death or attend his cousin Mohammed's funeral as a result of the beating Israeli police had given him that same day that his cousin was brutally murdered by the Israeli extremists. Instead of the police protecting us, they taunted us and told us that Mohammed was just the first to be killed and that 300 Palestinians would be killed for the 3 teenagers who were killed. My son and family have been very traumatized by this whole experience. Our cousins are still in jail, and the only reason Tariq is out is because he's an American citizen and his beating was caught on tape. While some of the Israeli officials tried to justify the vicious beating my son received by smearing his name, my son has never been charged with any crime. Nothing can justify restraining the hands of a 15-year-old child and beating him unconscious. Although as Americans, we enjoy great freedom in America, in Jerusalem, we felt worse than second-class citizens by the Israeli government, who treated us differently because we had a different religion and ethnicity. Like my Palestinian cousins, I felt that my family had no rights. My son was viciously attacked while in custody. He was in jail for 4 days. We were forced to pay $1,000 bond, and my son faced 9 days of house arrest away from his family, although he committed no crime and faced no charges. When we left to America, Israeli police raided the family home where we were staying and arrested the males there. They are still being held today without any charges. The Israeli police involved in the beating of my son must be held accountable so that no other mother must go through the pain that I went through. My son still suffers from body aches and pain and headaches, not to mention the emotional trauma he must now struggle through. I just pray that America and the world can have the same sympathy for the countless children who are wrongfully arrested or even killed by Israel, who do not carry a U.S. passport like my son Tariq. None of this would have happened if the Israeli government valued the life of my son Tariq and other Palestinian, Muslim, and Christian children in the same way they value the life of Israeli children. Thank you.
This is One Land, Many Voices on 90.7 FM. You've been listening to Tariq and Suha Abu Khdair as they recounted their family nightmare when 15-year-old Tariq, a U.S. citizen, was beaten and imprisoned by Israeli occupation forces this last July in East Jerusalem. Another story we've been covering on One Land, Many Voices is that of Palestinian-American professor Stephen Salaita, who had his tenure-track appointment rescinded by the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign because of statements critical of Israel that Salaita tweeted during Israel's bombardment of Gaza in July and August. Since Salaita lost his job, 6,000 university professors from around the country have joined a boycott of the University of Illinois. Salaita is preparing to sue the university for violating his free speech rights and for breach of contract. Salaita spoke earlier this month at the University of Chicago about his ordeal. This is what he had to say.
Let me first acknowledge that what happened to me has been happening to ethnic, sexual, and cultural minorities in academe for decades, African Americans especially, and it continues to happen today. A shameful irony is that Jews were long marginalized in the academy because of their supposed dangers to Anglo civility. Victims to rationalizations for their exclusion that sadly don't look terribly different than the ones now being used against supporters of Palestinian human rights. The suppression of blackness and indigeneity predates the purge of Palestine and in many ways contextualizes and sustains it. The regulation of deviant bodies, ideas, and identities has influenced American campuses since their inception. I think more than anything, the egregiousness of UIUC's decision illustrates that the furtive codes of campus repression have become less necessary. Academia has never been free. Universities don't like to be openly repressive, however. There are countless mechanisms in place to ensure conformity to the imperatives of the powerful and wealthy. These mechanisms regulate tone, content, action, and access. They will become unnecessary only when campuses become openly dictatorial. UIUC took a significant and unapologetic step in that direction. Please bear in mind that board members have zero qualifications to evaluate my teaching or scholarship. They've never taught college. They know nothing about indigenous peoples, American Indians, the Israel-Palestine conflict, Palestine, the Middle East, Pacific Islanders, military occupation, native nationalism, literary criticism, hermeneutics, critical theory, decolonization, scholarship, journal publishing, peer review, university presses, departmental service, advising, grading, curriculum, or how to compose a solitary footnote. How exactly this makes them qualified to make hiring decisions on behalf of the American Indian Studies program is a mystery. Siding with Israel isn't necessarily about making money. It's also about political ambition, conformity, establishment bona fides, state power. In other words, maintaining the status quo. It's about keeping power consolidated among the elite. It's about not setting the terrible precedent of allowing the colonized a say in their own futures. To be called political is immediately to become suspect among one's colleagues, to be marked as radical, another term with its own history of coerciveness. Serious scholars can never be radical. Let's look at the term most relevant to our current situation, civility, which is a reboot of the long-standing canard of collegiality. I believe that civility, although it performs the same coercive function as collegiality, is far more insidious and threatening. It's endemic to universities in particular because the conceits of shared governance and academic freedom must be delimited without open suppression, though open suppression happens plenty. Hence collegiality as a measure of performance. It is a sprawling and subjective word, which is precisely its utility. Valuable ideas disrupt, reorder, undermine, confront, subvert, unsettle, upset, menace, admonish, forebode. Critical thinking is fundamentally incompatible with conformity, which is collegiality's primary desire. Collegiality largely performs two functions. It can be used as a pretext to punish somebody whose work is stellar, but who doesn't fit in with colleagues. And here, the severe problems of race, class, gender, sexuality, and culture should be obvious. And it can name unconventional scholarship as inferior because it doesn't recycle established ideas and methodologies. Collegiality is the etiquette of submission. It's impossible to be collegial when challenging the common sense of corporate dominion, no matter how politely you state the criticism. I oppose the policies of the State of Israel. That's the extent of my engagement with Jewish culture, which is to say I have very little engagement with it at all. If people feel attacked on a cultural level when somebody condemns a nation state, then that's a problem of ethno-nationalism, not of political critique. There's nothing in my record as a scholar teacher that indicates even a scintilla of anti-Semitism. I go on record again to say that I detest the phenomenon. For all of you tweeting out what a horrible person I am, tweet that, anti-Semitism, I detest the phenomenon. Thank you. I'd love to see folks who condone the slaughter of children and the illegal settlement of foreign territory disavow themselves of anti-Arab racism. It's because Israel is the default norm of civility. Israelis are assumed to be human. To criticize them then is inherently aggressive. Palestinians, on the other hand, must loudly denounce aggression at every imaginable moment in order to be considered human in the first place, even as we suffer the unrelenting violence of Israeli colonization. Our barbarity is atavistic and imminent. It precedes our subjectivity, restricts our earthly presence, and marks us as inferior. We can achieve the lofty status of pitiable only when we grovel. Israel is losing the PR battle, the proverbial hearts and minds. Its supporters, in turn, are lashing out with the sort of desperation endemic to any strong party in decline. They are punitive and belligerent in the absence of honest debate. This is about deeply undemocratic power reasserting itself, refusing to cede even a word to Palestinians in a deeply compromised public discourse. It is, simply stated, colonial paranoia. This should be easy for anybody to see. If your first impulse upon encountering a viewpoint you dislike is to punish the speaker, then you tacitly confess that your position has no merit. And now civility is spreading through universities as quickly as settlers overwhelmed the North American continent. Administrators love the word. It means anything they want it to mean and always implies something sinister without having to justify or explain. The term perfectly encapsulates the sheer force of panic that pervades the elite when they need to find an effortless way to hamper debate. Debate is usually inimical to their interests. There's one thing I remember most from the episodes of unmitigated brutality in Gaza this summer. The ice cream freezers. Nothing affected me more. Few things better exemplify the gaiety and innocence of childhood than rummaging through boxes of frozen confections. During Israel's recent bombing campaign in Gaza, however, the ice cream freezers weren't stacked with popsicles and sorbet. Instead, they stored the bodies of dead children. The symbolism is endless. Ice cream and children's bodies. They usually intermingle in messy harmony. This time, though, the bodies had replaced the treats. The children had nothing to imbibe. Their corpses were on display for a much different sort of rummaging. They were in ice cream freezers because morgues had run out of space. A problem not only of warfare, but of overcrowded neighborhoods and geographical entrapment. Gaza's lack of electricity threatened rapid decomposition. The children rested atop one another in containers that likely provided some of their happiest moments when they were alive. There's nothing poetic about this juxtaposition. It's a terrible algorithm of combustion and confinement. Thus, I tweeted, "The evidence in my case is clear. I'm no anti-Semite. I'm no terrorist. I'm no bully. I'm no savage. I'm a man who was fired because I condemned Israeli policy in language appropriate to a horrible occasion rather than in the meek platitudes of civility. I prefer moral clarity. After all, there's nothing civil about dead children in an ice cream freezer." Thank you.
You're listening to One Land, Many Voices. That was Professor Stephen Salaita speaking before students and faculty at the University of Chicago earlier this month about the loss of his tenured track position at the university because of tweets he authored critical of Israeli actions in Gaza. You're listening to One Land, Many Voices on 90.7 FM KBOO Radio. Let's take a look now at how nationally and locally activists have been working to bring attention to the issues affecting justice in Palestine-Israel in cases like Tariq Abu Khdeir and Stephen Salaita that we just heard in the first segment of the show. We are joined in the studio by Peter Miller, two-term co-chair of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation and current president of the Portland-based Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights. Peter, thank you for coming out of your recent retirement with the U.S. campaign to be here at KBOO.
Oh, thank you very much, Zaha, for having me on your show.
These have been very busy times in the last year for Palestine solidarity work. We've seen an amazing increase in settlement activity under Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's administration. Then the uptick in settler violence, which young Mohammed and Tariq Abu Khdeir fell victim to. Just Sunday, two little girls were purposefully run over by an Israeli settler in the West Bank, killing one of them, five-year-old Inas Shokat. Then we had the Gaza bombardment invasion for 52 days in July and August, which resulted in 2,100 Palestinian dead, 70% of whom were civilians. We've had Palestinian Americans targeted for speaking out about events in Palestine. We've just heard from Stephen Salaita in the previous segment. But there's also the case of Rasmiya Ouda, a 67-year-old Palestinian-American woman, a survivor of a brutal Israeli torture and imprisonment in 1969, who was facing revocation of her U.S. citizenship and deportation for what many attribute to her activism on Palestine. Peter, talk with us a bit about what the U.S. campaign has been doing to support scholars and activists like Stephen Salaita and Rasmiya Ouda, as well as how it has been working to raise awareness about Gaza and the issues affecting Palestinian human rights.
Yeah, thank you, Zaha. U.S. campaign, of course, is a coalition of groups that has grown over the years, as well as our staff. On the Rasmiya case, it's being led by the U.S. Palestinian Community Network and the Committee to Stop FBI Repression. And in this case, the U.S. campaign plays an important supporting role in trying to get the word out about the case and about the actions of the local organizations. Unfortunately, the U.S. campaign staff is so small, and the need these days is so great that, you know, we need to start thinking about growing, how we can grow all of our organizations to be more effective. But in this case, you know, we're trying to get the Department of Justice to drop what is really a pretty obviously a harassment case against a well-respected community leader, 67 years old, who's been here for many, many years, decades, and now they're going after her. And It just shows, I think, that institutionally, the support for Israel, supporters of Israel, are starting to get active to combat our actions to bring justice to Palestinians, because the deep institutional support for Israel in our government, in our academic institutions, and so on, it's very difficult for Palestinian Americans, Muslim Americans, to start to speak out, because they are justifiably worried that things like the Department of Justice and other immigration or others are going to start, you know, going after them in various ways.
You know, what's interesting, Peter, about Rasmiya's case, in fact, is that the federal prosecutor tried to sequester the jury, not wanting the jury to be aware of, you know, the publicity and the protests and all that's been going on effectively to raise awareness about Rasmiya's case, because they have been so effective. The activists have been very effective in getting the word out about her case and showing up at all of the hearings. So talk a little bit about what the campaign is able to do to raise awareness in that way on specific cases like Salaita's and Rasmiya Ouda's.
Well, the U.S. campaign, of course, has a coalition of over 400 organizations and many thousands of people on our email lists. And so we are able to really mobilize quite a few people on any case like this that comes to our attention. And I think that's a big, valuable aspect of the work, to raising awareness, and also working with our existing member organizations like the U.S. Palestinian Community Network to bolster all the efforts of all these local groups that are doing such important work.
You know, I should add about the issue of the federal prosecutors. You know, there hasn't been a jury selected yet, and yet the federal prosecutor wants to curb all the protests around Rasmiya even before there's actually been a jury selected. So it's a bizarre case, and just shows, you know, just how important it is for people to continue to talk about these cases and to talk to our elected officials about these cases.
And we're probably going to see more of this kind of thing, because you know, as Nelson Mandela would say, that or Gandhi would say, you know, when you're fighting against systems of injustice, that first they ignore you, and then they, you know, fight you, and then you win. We're at the point where these institutional supports for Israel are fighting back against our efforts to bring justice. And I might add about Rasmiya that she was a victim of Israeli torture in 1969. So she has been, you know, tortured and mistreated by the Israeli government, and now the U.S. is going after this torture victim who's, you know, 67 years old. It's just crazy.
You know, talk to us a bit about the affirmative actions that the U.S. campaign is leading, like the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. What campaigns are going on around the country, and how have they been successful over time?
Well, I mean, this is an exciting area of all of our work, because the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to put pressure on Israel to end its various injustices is really gathering momentum both in the United States and around the world. And the U.S. campaign staff are really involved in trying to make all of these various activities, you know, stronger as best we can, because we realize this is really important. And there's just a wide variety of things that people can do, because it turns out if you start digging around, our connections to Israel are all around us, either in our academic institutions. Portland's chief of police has gone to Israel in the past. Our senators are taking these trips to Israel, and stores are selling settlement products. So G4S, which is a security company which runs Israeli prisons, is also running, you know, TriMet Security. So there's all sorts of things to be done. There's almost more to be done than we have people to do it right now. But that's changing, and the U.S. campaign has really been involved in bolstering efforts by churches to divest, like the Presbyterian Church has been deeply involved in campaigns like TIA CREF, the retirement fund giant, trying in the We Divest campaign, trying to get that company to divest from Israeli settlement products and from companies doing business in Israel. Another good one is the SodaStream boycott campaign, which we have a very active Portland SodaStream boycott campaign in Portland, trying to get stores like Kitchen Caboodle and Target to stop carrying this settlement product. And there's another campaign in Portland that's starting up that the U.S. campaign is very interested in, is the G4S. And G4S is this global security company. I've been told it's one of the largest private employers in the world, about over 600,000 employees. And they have their fingers in security all over the world, including in Portland, but including in Israeli jails. They run the prisons that jail Palestinian children, put people in solitary confinement. They run the some of the immigration on the U.S. Southern border, the procedures to deport people. They run, I guess, TriMet Security. They're, you know, the Bank of America uses them for their security here in Portland. So some really good targets here, because a company like G4S is involved in the whole privatization of controlling citizens of countries and undesired people. And so that's certainly the issue with immigration. It's people of color, African-American communities, all
these. Speaking of that, you know, the U.S. campaign has been a really involved as well in raising awareness, like you say, about the connections between sort of different communities in Palestine. And one of those has been the relationship between what's happened in Ferguson and the situation in Palestine. Members of the U.S. campaign have recently traveled to St. Louis to take part in the rally there and to show their solidarity. Can you tell us about those connections between Ferguson and Palestine, and why activists for Palestine feel it's so important to stand with Ferguson?
Well, I think on the base level, we realize that we're not all operating as individually in isolation, that we are all part of a collective, and that injustice is all around us, not just in Palestine, but here in the United States, and that it's critical if we're going to grow as a movement, but as a society, that we stop compartmentalizing, and that we combine forces with like-minded people seeking justice, even if the issues are a little different. It was surprising that the people in Ferguson were very appreciative, because even people in Gaza, while they were still being attacked by Israel or, you know, undergoing the aftermath of Israel's attack, were tweeting to the people in Ferguson, giving them advice of how to deal with tear gas. And so, you know, there was this sudden realization that we recognize each other's issues. I think that's very valuable. And certainly the U.S. campaign wants to build stronger connections across communities in this country, communities of color, because we realize that we're all suffering from the lack of power to change our various situations, and we need to start coming together more and maybe understand each other's issues more, be aware of that there's just injustice going on in our own community, not just over in Palestine. We all need to be a little more aware of what's going on. And I think we're trying to get serious about how we could make this kind of cross-movement work actually happen in a way that's respectful of all the communities.
Now, and there's really some very direct connections between Ferguson and Palestine in that the sheriff and some of the law enforcement have even traveled to Israel to get trained on crowd control. I mean, and we see the results of that training and how they dealt with the protesters, the nonviolent protesters.
That's right.
That were trying to show their feelings about having an unarmed black man, another unarmed black man killed in their community, and in very similar sort of way that you might see a Palestinian protester killed in the West Bank or in Gaza. So, you know, there is that indirect sort of similarities in terms of what their experience is, but there's also that very direct where, you know, you have Israeli army teaching law enforcement in the U.S. How to deal with protesters.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's some, you know, there's each is its own injustice unto its own because they're different situations. The violence against African Americans come out of our history in the United States. And then the violence against the Palestinians come about from the history over there. But injustice has a similar face on everything you do. But like you say, there's some surprising, you know, more direct connections. The tear gas being used against the people in Ferguson is the same tear gas, even the same company making tear gas to use against Palestinians or against Egyptians or Tunisians. The Israeli peace activist Jeff Halper calls these interconnections the global Palestine, meaning that there is more and more effort on the security aspects of countries to deal with undesired populations, you know, and rounding them up and jailing them, imprisoning people, using, you know, more maximum military force, surveilling people, like the NSA is surveilling us and Israel is surveilling Palestinians. And in fact, the NSA is, according to Edward Snowden, is giving Israel raw, surveillance data of Americans to the Israeli security state. So there's more than just a passing relationship. It's often the same corporations, and Israel's intentionally trying to build security relationships with police forces in the United States, and so on and so forth. So there's some surprising connections when you start digging into it.
Surprising and yet not so surprising at the same time, right?
It turns out not so surprising. When you start to see these, you realize we're all in part of a global system, really. You know, that it's a system sort of empire or, and a control that has a big corporate component as well as a governmental component. Corporations make money. Unfortunately, they can make money off of misery just as much as they can make money off of positive things. And so, you know, corporations get into the privatization of security, end up, that the more security you have to have, the better it is for the bottom line of these corporations.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate incentive there for their business. You know, we have just a few minutes left, Peter, but I wanted to give you the chance to talk about a play that AUPHR, Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights here in Portland, is helping to put on. It's the Rachel Corey play. Could you talk a little bit about that and let people know how they can get tickets to come and see that?
Yeah, it's very exciting to be able to bring this play by a new actor who's seems very dynamic, and we're going to be able to have a discussion after it, and it's going to be at the Elliott Chapel at the First Unitarian Church Sunday, November 9th, starting at 7 p.m. And Rachel Corey was the young woman in Olympia, Washington, who was killed by an Israeli-operated Caterpillar bulldozer back in 2003 in Gaza. And her her parents, Cindy and Craig Corey, have basically taken on their daughter's struggle in a very significant and really heartwarming way. And Rachel Corey was a wonderful young woman who, you know, lost her life very young. And her writings show, you know, kind of what we did lose here, this wonderful person who was thinking about human rights and thinking about life and her and injustice. And her writings really show that. And this play really does a good job of showing the inner world of Rachel Corey and her thoughts. And she's a very wonderful person to get to know through this play.
Peter Miller, former chair of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation and current president of the Portland-based Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights. Thank you so much for joining us today on One Land, Many Voices, KBOO 90.7 FM.
Thank you very much, Zaha.
This is KBOO Portland. Time is 9:58 a.m. Coming up at 10, it's Chris Andre, hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. Followed at 10:15 with Flashpoints, looking at how the shooting in Canada's parliament is being used to ramp up the war against ISIS. We'll also hear about the role of the Koreas in what is being labeled as the U.S. strategic pivot, and about the role of UC Berkeley in the new nuclear arms race. At 11 on the incomparable Radio Zine, Suzanne LeGrand hosts Startup City with a focus on new opportunities for jobs in the tech industry, and Sarika Mehta speaks with Rick Steves and Jose Antonio Vargas. And at 11:30, Chris Andre is back to discuss Imago Theater's production of Harold Pinter's The Homecoming. That's all coming up on your community radio, KBOO Portland. And now, this.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot
to
Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. for Roots of Rock and Roll. Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop. From the birth of rock and roll, the 50s and early 60s. Roots of Rock and Roll, only on KBOO Portland.